It's the Mike O'Mara Show.
I've got an eclectic reading list.
Our panelists are about to fall out, wondering. All right. As the old guy said, you're just not a potted plant.
Thank you, W.
Makes
Welcome
sense.
Back to the Mike O'Mara Show. Hi. It's our phone number, 877-365-3636. I want to remind you once again, if you want to vote on the worst song of all time, tell us yours now at MikeO'MaraShow.com. It's on the homepage, right to the right of the photo of the day. And do we still have the Catwoman up? Is that our photo of the day? Probably
check.
Still is.
We did earlier.
We will tabulate all the entries and have the final results this Friday afternoon with Scott the Dwarf during BYOB Friday, the worst song of all time. Vote now at MikeO'MaraShow.com.
And if you're a woman, while you're there, sign up to be a buzz babe.
Yes, you can do that as well.
Always.
All right, let's get this next lady on the line. Her name is Kate Brennan, and we're going to speak to her right now. The book is In His Sights. This is a true story of love and obsession, and I got to the very front part of this book, and it's frightening that, but this happens all the time.
Sure.
And I think that if we don't know people personally who have been through this, we've certainly heard about this. Kate is not her real name. She broke up with Paul, moved out of his house, thinking it was over. It wasn't. Paul stalked Kate for, I believe, over 10 years.
Wow.
Paul is wealthy, so he has lots of stalking time. He tracks her movements. He reroutes her mail, hires people to break into her home, interferes with her work, and even relocates to her neighborhood. Paul, incidentally, as this book is out, is still on the loose, and Kate remains in hiding, and she joins us right now. Kate Brennan. Kate, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for giving me the chance to talk about my book.
Kate, the very first thing when I looked at the front of this book, the prologue for this, and I have to tell you, is that this has been going on, I think, are we talking 13 years that this has been going on?
14 now.
Wow.
14 now. I'm stunned that this could actually continue, and you'd have to deal with this. But I guess if a person's savvy enough and cunning enough, something like this can last for 13 years.
Yes. My situation is not ordinary. I just want to say most stalking kind of averages about 2 years. So the length of time that mine has gone on is unusual.
Wow.
But this man has enough money and enough resources to keep it going.
You obviously knew your stalker, know your stalker. He's still out there, and that means he's not in jail. And the first question, I think, for an average person would be, why is that?
How?
When so much of this has gone on, when
right.
you're talking about somebody hiring people to break into your house, is he just that devious that he can get away with this kind of stuff? Why hasn't somebody, and I know there are laws out there, why isn't this guy locked up right now?
Well, when the stalking first started for me, it was just when stalking law started to come on the books.
Right.
So today, I believe the police have more resources. People are more savvy about it. I believe, actually, if this had happened to me today, there would have been more hope for me to get help or stop it early. But the fact that this man has so much money, he knows he's got friends who are hackers,
right.
computer hackers.
Right.
But what he does, he doesn't leave tracks. You know, my home won't be broken into in a physical way. Mm-hmm. Someone will have gotten in, you know, presumably with a key or picking the lock or something, and a few things will be rearranged. Well, pretty hard to point to that.
Yeah.
Or if I come out in my car, new car, and this happened to me years ago, and the battery was suddenly dead with no warning, you know, and my car was tampered with, but no fingerprints.
Mm. And you mentioned, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you mentioned that he hired people to do this. Is there direct contact with him very often, or does he do this kind of long distance that you just know he's around, but obviously he has people, you know, he's a man of means, so he has people working for him?
Yes, it's the latter. I saw him once in all of these 14 years. I happened to be in a bookstore and I saw him. Other than that, I haven't seen him or talked to him since I told him to leave me alone, which was early on. And I want to just say, for anyone out there who is being stalked, that's just kind of the number one rule. No matter what, you just have to stop all contact, because that just feeds their obsessive nature, and it's what they want.
That's pouring the gasoline on the fire with this. You know, since we are one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is to help people that might feel like they're in a situation,
right.
either a man or a woman, and it does go both ways with that. If you're in a situation like this, you talk about having a high tolerance for cruelty based on your upbringing. And so you were not able to see some of the warning signs with this guy and some of these perversions that he had. Talk about that. You came from a tough upbringing. Is that what you were referring to?
Well, in some regards. In some regards, I came from a very nice upbringing. There was a lot of love in the family, but I happened to come from an alcoholic family. And my father's nature was to be full of rage when he was drunk. And so I grew up with a pretty high tolerance for emotional and verbal abuse. There was some physical, but mostly it was verbal and emotional. And so when you're brought up in that kind of family where that there's a, you know, there isn't a check to rage, it kind of raises the bar for what seems natural to you. So that was part of it for me. But the other part of it was there was an extenuating circumstance or an unusual circumstance in this man's life when I first met him, which is shortly after I met him. And he was the nephew of a good friend of mine. So there was a, you know, a friend-family connection there.
Kind of a, you know, you would think in a normal way, a great way to meet somebody.
Sure. Exactly, exactly, which kind of, I think, can give you a false sense of security, actually.
Right.
But this man's father was tortured and murdered, and his secret life came to light. And so, you know, there it was really, our early dating was in the middle of some horrific, you know, a murder investigation, a murder trial. And so I was encouraged to kind of give him a pass. He kept saying, this isn't, you know, if I was disturbed by his secretive behavior or...
And you would think that was, and in many cases, that would be normal behavior.
Right.
If somebody's under a great deal of stress at that particular time, they might wig out a little bit once in a while. But obviously, you know, if you'd known what you know today, you would have gotten out of that that situation.
I would have run like hell.
Yeah. Now I'm curious about, you know, when you start to really... I don't want you to give away the whole book, but tell us the very first time you said, you know, boy, this has gone completely out of whack, and I've got to get out of this. Was there a catalyst? Everybody does have that one moment where you say, okay, I've got to sever this relationship. What was the catalyst for you?
Well, there were times when I did end the relationship, and I allowed him to talk me back. So I take responsibility for that. I allowed myself to be talked back into it.
Right.
But toward the end, I started learning things about his past. He turned out to be a sex addict. And so I found out about that addiction and how he behaved when he was an active addict and his addiction.
Was he cheating on you on a regular basis?
I believe he was at the end.
Right.
And then he started, I remember there was one thing that I talk about in the book. I found out he had a pistol in the house, and I didn't like that, and I told him I didn't like it, and he said he wasn't going to do anything about it. But every once in a while, toward the very end, we'd be in bed together, and he'd say, "Now you remember I have a gun in the house, right?" And he never actually hurt me physically.
Right.
But that really started to terrify me. I realized that.
So he would, Kate, he would say that in the context of like an argument or you'd had a rough evening, and then he would make a reference to that just in passing. In other words, it was a threat?
Yes, but you know what? Sometimes it was in reference to nothing.
Right. I mean,
you know, just we would be in bed going to sleep.
And even creepier if he just blurted out, you know,
yeah,
I have a gun, and that starts to get
right.
You. So,
yeah.
when did you make the final break with him?
Well, it was less than 3 years that we were together between dating, and then I lived with him for about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of, you know, short of 3 years together, I left. And then that's when the stalking began, although I didn't recognize it stalking right away. I think a lot of people are like me, that they just think, oh, he's mad. I broke off the relationship, and it became clear to me that he wasn't used to that. He ended relationships, and he was furious.
Oh.
I was the one who walked away. And so at first I thought it was just his desire to get me back and not that it would be a good relationship. I just thought he wanted to get me back so he could end it at another time.
Which might have been a fine situation. I mean, I'm sure you would have settled for that just to end things, right?
Well, right. And also I was one of the few women in his life who wouldn't take his money. He kind of paid women off and kept them in his life and gave them gifts or regular checks. And my friends and I later joked, if we'd only known that, you know, if we could have pretended he ended the relationship and I took some money from him. Mm-hmm. You know, my friends used to say, you know, we'll go get the money, you know, if you'll stop this. We'll get a check for you and you can give it to charity.
Oh, boy. You know, you talk in your book about the fact that, you know, you can't walk into a movie theater. This is 10 years of this that you've endured. You're careful anywhere you go in public. You talk about whether it's nighttime, that you feel like you have the cover of night, however you prefer the daylight. And just anything you hear, that this is constant. How do you keep your sanity in that situation where this is obviously in your mind 24/7? You're always thinking about this,
right? And I have to say that I live in a state of constant hypervigilance, which isn't a healthy state to live in. It's very stressful, and you know, I've suffered because of that. But I have gotten lots of help. I've had a great therapist. I have very good friends, and they have helped me keep sane and feel loved and feel safe in the world to the extent that I can. But it's a very stressful way to live.
I would, and I'm asking this on the fly here because I just occurred to me. Your purpose for writing the book, because is it a cathartic thing that you just want to get this out, share your story with everybody? Are you trying to help other people with this? Because you would think, you know, in the hypervigilant state that you're in, you'd want to do very little to pour gasoline on the fire, so to speak.
Right, and the reality is it was very difficult for me to decide to write this book. And what made the decision for me was this man has robbed me of the chance of a normal life as long as he's alive. And even then, you know, he took away some good years. I could have been doing a lot of other things instead of spending all my time and money trying to stay safe and invisible from him. So there was a point in time where I thought my nature is to live an engaged life, to do a lot of volunteer work, to give back to the world. And I haven't been able to do that in the way I always had because I've had to live such a secret life. And he's taken away some really good writing opportunities. You know, I haven't felt safe to write under my own name because it would give information about where I was or what I did. So there was a part of it. It's really two things. Part of it, it's my way to kind of take my life back as a writer. Uh-huh. I'm a writer. It's what I do.
Right.
And this is a huge story in my life.
Uh-huh.
And so in a way, it's reclaiming myself.
Right.
The other thing and the significant thing that kept me going when it was just so painful to write this and to think about putting it out into the world, not knowing what would happen, I have the ability to speak for millions of people who experience this. About 1. I think it's 3 million people or 1.2 million people every year are stalked.
Wow! How many of those are women? What's the percentage that are women?
About a million are women.
A million, many more women, right?
Right. The vast majority are women, and usually if it's not a stranger, random stalking, if it's someone we've been intimate with, I think we tend to feel ashamed or embarrassed or afraid to be very public, and so we isolate ourselves or we just, you know, don't talk about it. And it's a horrible thing. Your freedom is taken away. Your ability to trust freely is taken away. And I felt really an obligation because I have the ability to write and to tell my story, to be a voice for the millions who suffer, you know, this crime and don't feel like they get much help about it.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. The law's still woefully inadequate as far as stalking is concerned. Any progress on that front as far as stalking laws? Because you hear about that all the time, that it's very difficult to prosecute these people.
Right. And one of the things that I'm encouraged to see happening is there's a difference or there's a change in some of the laws in terms of intent. So that it used to be that someone had to prove they intended to harm or cause fear.
Right.
And, you know, if the people who stalk, you know, they're not very reasonable, rational people. And so to get into that conversation of did they mean to harm you seems a silly conversation to me. And so some of the laws are acknowledging that's a fine line that shouldn't have to, the burden of proof should not be on the victim of the crime.
It's so tough. It's so tough, isn't it? I mean, it really is a very difficult thing legally when you're talking about that. And I think that's what allows a lot of this crap to go on. I would be curious as to whether you have ever thought about taking the, you know, as bad as it might sound, taking the law into your own hands in a situation like this. I know that if I, you know, if I had a daughter or someone that was close to me, woman, I mean, it's tough. Mm-hmm. You don't want to go to prison yourself, but you say to yourself, you know, when's this going to end? I mean, is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
I have a rich fantasy life.
Understood.
I'll leave it at that.
Is there a red flag that, from your experience, that you might pass on to other people, something to watch out for, to defend themselves against this happening to them?
Yes, because I think it's the kind of the same things that bothered me in the relationship, you know, are kind of mirrored in the stalking experience. And a lot of it goes down to a desire to control and have power over the other person. And the stalking types are, they're manipulative, deceitful. They make themselves the victim. Everything, you know, they don't take responsibility for themselves.
Right.
And any time you have a person who is too eager to profess love too quickly and too attentive and, you know, too... you know, too desirous of trying to really impact your life in every way.
Right.
That's a huge red flag.
Boy, you know, I think of friends of mine that I have known that have been in relationships where they've gone, you know, where it's gone very quickly.
Right.
Where suddenly, you know, you're seeing a couple of your buddies dating a woman, and all of a sudden they're living together, and then they're, you know, they're starting an engagement. And I really, and I've seen some of those really blow up badly, and that's an interesting red flag that you have there. Paul is still on the loose. That's one of the things you get out of the book that is very disconcerting to me. You remain in hiding. Do we have any kind of solution in the offing? Is there any? I mean, the idea, and what depresses me, even talking to you and hearing about your story, is that there will be no resolution to this. Perhaps. For as long as you live, and that's got to be amazingly frustrating. Do you continuously work to change that situation?
Well, I don't live in hiding as deeply as I did a number of years ago. So I've tried different things, moving regularly. You know, like, and by that I mean living with friends or having short-term leases.
Wow.
Or and I did that, and I have for the last handful of years lived in one place. I live very privately. So I'm not hidden in quite the same way. I don't live under a different name. I'm writing under a different name. And when I travel, some of that is under a different name, although hard since 9/11 to do it the way I used to.
Have you been able to pursue another relationship while this is going on?
You know, I haven't. It hasn't felt worth it to me because this is not the kind of life I want to invite someone into.
He robbed you for a lot.
Having said that, I just want to say there's, in some ways, the triumph for me is, while it still goes on, the triumph for me is that I was able to write this book.
Right.
It was an enormous accomplishment for me to do it. And so this is, in my way, I think, breaking with the past and saying, I'm not going to be silent any longer. And I'm not sure what that means in the future, but I don't feel... that he has robbed me of many things, but he has not broken my spirit.
Good.
And so in that way, he hasn't won. This is difficult, but he hasn't won.
Well, I'm sorry, and this is, you know, we've got a lot of male listeners on this radio station. I still want to go kick his ass.
True.
That's just the way, that's the way I look at it. And, I wish seriously,
I
wish for you, Kate, I wish for you to seriously, you know, go out to like a friend's cocktail party somewhere, wherever you are, and meet Tony Soprano. I swear to God, that's what I think that, you know, as the father of two daughters, it's a very difficult situation, but you've got a tremendous amount of courage coming out and writing this book. And, you know, I think the only thing I can say, because I feel bad for your situation, although you have made progress, and I think your book will help people to recognize the signs of this. But I also think that, you know, you have to know that at the end of the day, this guy's going to get his just reward. I really think that's going to happen.
One
and I hope you think that, too.
I really do. I think in one way or another, what we send out into the world comes back to us.
Right. I agree. The book is In His Sights, A True Story of Love and Obsession. You know, it's real life, folks, and there's not the happy ending.
And that's what's
frustrating. But if you're interested in this, or you know somebody that might be in a relationship where you could see signs of this type of thing, read this book, In His Sights, Kate Brennan. Kate, I know that's not your real name, but I hope that everything goes well, and I hope you do find peace and happiness in your life, and we appreciate you coming on the show.
I really appreciate the chance to talk to your listeners. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Kate.
That's
okay.
Kate Brennan, and makes
creepy,
me mad. It really
it?
Does. I gotta get that taste out of my mouth.
Very unsatisfying.
Get the book anywhere, Amazon, Borders, all those places.
I have to wonder if he is, still after her or whatever the situation is, if he gets a copy of this book somehow, will it help her case? Or make him desire it even more.
You don't know. You don't know the level of psycho this guy.
And
it sounds to me when you're
creepy.
Talking about you're talking, Rob, about he's wealthy, he has lots of time to do this. He tracks her movements, he reroutes her mail, he hires people to break into her home, interferes with her work. He doesn't sound like perhaps he's a direct physical threat to her, but he sounds like he's just a spoiled son of a bitch.
A mental threat.
A mental case and a spoiled son of a bitch.
A constant creepy presence.
So read this book. I think it's got a lot of insights in there on how to deal with this and maybe better yet, how to avoid this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So very interesting.
Sure.
All right. I'm ready to clear the palate. Are you ready to clear the palate, please? It's been a weird show today, but I've had a fun time doing it.
Rightly so.
We're going to play Password.
Yay.
We need four listeners ready to play online. The first two will pair up with a show member of their choice. The other two will remain on hold waiting to play. One at a time, the first two play four rounds with the show member. Does that sound right to you?
Yes.
Each round is five words in 30 seconds.
That's right.
The players get 1 point for each word guessed.
That's right.
I never should have asked for this. The player with the most points at the end of the four rounds will go on to the final round.
Right.
Yay.
So we're
going
to play Password. If you would like to play, 877-365-3636. We'll play Password. And, I got to mention the prize.
Is it good?
Prize? Yeah, we have a grand prize. A four-pack of Nissan Z seats to check out the Mayhem Festival this Sunday at Nissan Pavilion.
Comfy.
These are really, really cool seats. They're right out of that, that car.
From the Z car.
They have replicated four actual seats for the Nissan Z car and
nice.
Set them up side by side at the Nissan Pavilion for the Mayhem Festival. Mayhem Festival with Dragon Force, Mastodon, Under Oath, and more.
I am so pissed I already bought my seat.
This Sunday at the Nissan Pavilion, the four Z seats are courtesy of Nissan and our local Nissan dealer. So, you want to play Password? We're going to do that when we come up on the show.
Whoa. It's the Mike O'Mara Show.